Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and the chair of this program. It is my pleasure to extend a special welcome to any new club members who are here. We know you will enjoy your membership and look forward to seeing you often. At this time, please turn off all cell phones and other noise-making devices. Here are a couple of our upcoming Health and Medicine Forum events. On Thursday, February 25th, Ephraim Korngold will speak on Chinese medicine between heaven and earth. He wrote a book in 1991 that's still very current, and he's in practice in San Francisco as a Chinese health medicine person. On Thursday, March 4th, Paula Braverman from UCSF will speak about the sociology of health and disease. These are just two of our upcoming programs, and I invite you to pick up a copy of the new Commonwealth publication in the lobby or check our website for a complete listing of our events. You may register for these programs online or by calling Club's 24-hour reservation line. We'll handle questions today by a microphone I'll bring around the audience. David Simon's book, Free to Love, will be sold in the alcove or library after the meeting. And we have to end this meeting promptly at 1 o'clock for another program in this meeting. So the speaker will speak for about 45 minutes, then we'll have 10, 15 minutes for questions. So now I turn the meeting over to Adria Breyer, who will introduce our speaker.
Welcome, everyone. We are fortunate here at the Commonwealth Club to have an incredible array of top-line speakers. Dr. Simon is one of them. He is cutting-edge, and he's been cutting-edge for decades. I'm going to go slowly so you can hear everything about him. He's a world-renowned authority in the field of mind-body medicine. As a practicing physician, innovative researcher, and insightful teacher, David continues to expand his vision for an effective and compassionate healthcare system. More than three decades ago, as an anthropology student exploring humanity's earliest communities and cultures, he was drawn to understanding that the role of the doctor was much more than a disease technician. How present day is this? He is a true healer to be a diagnostician, medicine man, psychotherapist, and priest, an expert navigator of the mind and spirit as well as the physical body, which basically means you also have to use your intuition. And in today's medical world, oftentimes we're being shuffled back and forth. So again, somebody like Dr. Simon is just a remarkable gift to all of us. Integrating ancient wisdom healing traditions with modern scientific principles, he's forged a model of health that integrates the multiple dimensions of a human being, environmental, physical, emotional, psychological, and spiritual. As a board-certified neurologist, an expert in Ayurvedic medicine and other traditional healing arts, he brings a unique perspective to the relationship between mind, emotions, and health. In 1996, he co-founded and assumed the role of medical director of the Schoper Center for Well-Being in Southern California, where he continues to serve as the driving force in developing and leading the center's programs and seminars in mind-body medicine, emotional healing, and spirituality. You can find the center online. Recognized as a leading authority in the effective and appropriate use of mind-body medicine practices, his endeavors have resulted in the training, and thank you very much, of thousands of physicians, nurses, and healthcare providers. He was one of the first recipients of the revered National Institute of Health grant to study mind-body medicine approaches to improving healthcare. That is cutting edge. That is before we even knew what we were talking about. David continues to bring integrated mind-body medical programs to medical institutions, health centers, educational institutions, and health resorts throughout the world. He's the popular author of many wellness books, including Return to Wholeness, The Wisdom of Healing, Vital Energy, The Ten Commandments, and the phenomenal new book, Free to Love, Free to Heal. He's also co-authored many books with Dr. Deepak Chopra. He will mention, hopefully, the website. Is it chopra.org? Chopra.com, so write that down because you'll find a lot of value information. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Simon.
So, thank you. I knew from a fairly early age that I was going to be a physician. I think it's because in my culture of origin, it was determined that a fetus becomes a human being when it graduates from medical school. I was a child of the 60s, and so as I was preparing my pre-med requirements, I wanted a broader perspective than simply majoring in biology or chemistry. So I studied the role of medicine in cultures around the world, and I actually did my senior thesis on shamanism. As a result of that exploration, I became interested in the holistic practices of the East. So between undergraduate and medical school, I became a yoga and meditation teacher. So I thought I had all the right ingredients when I started medical school. I knew about witch doctors and transcendence. But when I entered into school, I realized that my worldview was quite different than the prevailing mindset. And it took me almost my entire medical training to finally get what my teachers were trying to tell me. And basically, what doctors believe is that we, human beings, are basically biochemical bags, that we're molecular machines. Therefore, if you accept the fact that we're basically just biochemistry, then when anything goes wrong with the human being, it makes sense that we would look to see how we can manipulate the biochemistry. So, you know, if you go to your doctor and complain that you're having heartburn or what we now call gastroesophageal reflux disease, it's pretty uncommon that your doctor's going to ask you about whether or not you're feeling stressed at work, because the doctor is thinking that this symptom is the result of excessive production of hydrochloric acid molecules, and therefore you'll be prescribed a proton pump inhibitor like Prilosec. If you go to your doctor, they check your blood pressure, and you find out that you have high blood pressure, again, it's unlikely that they're going to ask you, are you having marital stress? More likely, they'll say, oh, you have too many angiotensin molecules circulating in your bloodstream. So here's an angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitor, like lisinopril, and we'll treat your blood pressure. If you're having trouble sleeping at night, it's unlikely that your physician is going to ask you about whether or not you're stressed about over your credit card debt or you're not able to make your mortgage payments. Rather, this molecular model says insomnia is a result of inadequate levels of GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid molecule. So here's some Ambien or Restoril or that little butterfly medicine, which raises your GABA levels and you sleep, or at least go into a state of temporary anesthesia. And then, of course, if you're feeling depressed, it's not, from the Western model, a result of your relationships not nourishing you deeply, or maybe that you haven't found your real meaning and purpose in life. According to our molecular biochemical model, depression is a result of inadequate levels of serotonin, other catecholamines. So we'll prescribe a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. And right now in this room, at least 30% of you are taking Prozac, Zoloft, Celexa, Paxil, one of these other ones. And of course, the problem with this model is that it's often too effective at treating the symptoms of a disease. So, you know, you have an argument with your spouse, you eat the leftover pizza right before you go to bed, you wake up an hour later with heartburn, and you rush to the medicine cabinet, take a couple tablespoons of Mylanta, and within 15 minutes your indigestion is relieved, and you've learned a really important lesson. Take your Mylanta before you go to bed. Not, can I improve the quality of this relationship? Maybe I shouldn't be eating leftover food. In fact, in Ayurveda, how many people have heard that word, Ayurveda? So it's becoming well known now. Ayurveda is this ancient healing system from India. In Ayurveda, there's actually a chapter on quackery. And it says that a doctor should be considered a quack when it treats the symptoms of a disease without looking to the origins of the illness. So in a lot of ways, we can see much of what we do in Western medicine as falling into that category, which of course doesn't mean that when we have an auto accident, we're not intensely appreciative of our neurosurgeons or orthopedists, and that when we get a urinary tract infection or a bacterial bronchitis, we're not really loved to the fact that we take our Zithromax. But it doesn't stop there. And in my experience over the last several decades that I've been practicing medicine is that the symptom is like a ticket that gets you in the doctor's door. The ticket may be a migraine, the ticket may be indigestion, the ticket may be constipation, the ticket may be lack of energy, the ticket may be pain in your body somewhere. But the ticket is your body's way of getting attention, similar to a child. You know, when a child wants its mom's attention, mommy, mommy, pay attention to me. And the mom will say, oh, hold on, honey, I'm balancing the checkbook. I'll get to you in 5 minutes. Child goes away, comes back. Mommy, mommy, I want to show you something. Hold on, honey, I just need a few more minutes. So this may go on a few times, but then the mother will recognize, wait, I haven't heard from my child in 15 minutes. She'll seek the child out and find out that they've taken everything out of the cupboard or emptied the medicine cabinet. The body is very similar in that it sends us signals. The signals are designed to get our attention, with the body attempting to get a need met that it's not otherwise having met. And if we don't pay attention to it, or we simply suppress the symptom with some ibuprofen or whatever temporary symptomatic relief, the body may stop demanding our attention for a little while, but when it comes back, it won't be ignored. So this is what I've been learning over the last 3+ decades that I've been practicing medicine. And what I've come to realize is that if we can provide the safe space, that symptom almost always is the top of a much deeper story. And that deeper story is almost always a love story. And that love story is almost always a sad love story. Of course, I'm not the first person to say this. In fact, if you look back at Michael Crichton's first book called Travels, he was still a medical student at Harvard. He describes in one of his stories that he was on his third year rotations, and he was in the coronary care unit. And it was pretty quiet that night, so he decided he would just go around and talk to his patients, an unusual phenomenon for physicians in training. And he went around just asking every patient, why do you think you have a heart attack? To his astonishment, there wasn't a single person who said, I have a heart attack because my LDL cholesterol is too high. They all had a story to tell, usually a story about a broken heart. They weren't appreciated at work. Their spouse was no longer affectionate to them. They're alienated from their children. And in their own stories, this emotionally broken heart ultimately eventually translated into an actual physical broken heart. Now, of course, Western medicine has denied these connections, kicking and screaming, for at least several decades now. But I'm happy to report that they no longer can deny the preponderance of the scientific information. So we're really in the midst of this revolution in thinking about this connection between our minds and our bodies. Just for example, there's a fascinating study that just was published in a medical journal called Psychosomatics. They looked at 500 people with an autoimmune disease. And as you're probably aware, an autoimmune disease is a condition where our immune systems become confused. So rather than doing their anticipated job of identifying and eliminating viruses and bacteria and cancer cells, in an autoimmune disease, the immune system gets confused and starts attacking our own tissues. So common autoimmune conditions, which really create tremendous suffering for people, are things like multiple sclerosis or rheumatoid arthritis or Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. So in this study, they looked at 500 people who were admitted to the hospital with one of these conditions, and they compared them to about 5,000 people who did not have one of these conditions, and they explored what they called adverse childhood experiences. They identified and looked for 7 really toxic experiences that children, unfortunately, are fairly commonly subjected to as we're growing up. So they were subjected to repeated emotional abuse, subjected to repeated physical abuse, subjected to any sexual abuse, violence in the household, alcoholism or drug addiction in the household, serious mental illness in the household, or being the pawn as your parents went through a very conflicted, toxic divorce. Okay. And what they found in this study is that for every one of these adverse childhood experiences, it increased our risk for an autoimmune disease by 20% decades later in adulthood. Something left over from our past had ultimately the effect of confusing our immune system 30, 40 years later. So there are now thousands and thousands of studies suggesting that our inner dialogue, the conversation that we're all having with ourselves on a perpetual basis, over time translates not only into our state of emotional and psychological well-being, but literally into our physical health as well. My experience is that the body wants to heal itself. That if we're carrying something toxic, something left over from the past that is no longer serving us, if we give the body and the mind the opportunity, it will move from the deeper regions to the surface and ultimately be eliminated. Similar to what happens if we get an abscess. So as you probably know, if you get an infection and the infection overwhelms your immune system, your immune system will do the next best thing to eliminating it, which will try to wall off the little pockets of infection in little capsules. It doesn't knock out the infection, but at least it keeps it from filling your entire system with that infection. But it still drains your biological energy. And over time, it will deplete you. I think in a lot of ways, we carry these emotional abscesses, disappointments, regrets, grievances, boundary violations from our past. We wall them off. We try to keep them as out of our conscious awareness as possible. But over time, they drain our vitality, they drain our enthusiasm, they deplete our happiness, and they make us sick. So everything that we do now at the Chopra Center for Well-Being, has anyone ever been up here, been down to the Chopra Center with us? Great. It's this little, what I call a spiritual intensive care unit in what I think is the sweet spot of the universe, which is Carlsbad, California. We look at a person from all these dimensions. And we ask the basic question, what are we carrying with us from the past that's not serving us in the present? And what are we holding ourselves back from in the present that if we allowed into our lives could start healing, transformation, awakening in the process? This book, Free to Love, is actually, in a sense, the manual of a course that we teach about 4 or 5 times a year, where we take people on this journey, this fairly intensive healing journey. We think of it in terms of a emotional detoxification. And so for people who can't come to these courses, I felt that this information was useful enough that it should be more widely available. So that's the kind of intention behind while I'm standing here in front of you. And I think since we don't have a lot of time, rather than trying to pile a ton of information into your minds, let's do something experiential. So is that okay with everybody? Okay. So what I'd like you to first do is to sit comfortably. Okay. And now, sitting comfortably, please close your eyes. And with your eyes closed, allow yourself to be aware of your body. So in your own mind's eye, do a body scan and see if there's any place in your body right now that's talking to you. And if it's a temporary tension, a temporary stress, a temporary constriction, then right now, just adjust your posture a little bit right now so that you're feeling more comfortable sitting in this place at this time. Okay. Now, bring your attention into your heart. And for the next few moments, simply allow yourself to feel your heart. Settle into your heart. Open up a dialogue with your heart. And without any resistance or anticipation, honestly, listen to the signals of comfort or discomfort that your sweetheart is sending to you. And now with your attention in your heart and with the imagination that your heart has wisdom and would like to communicate that knowingness to you, ask your heart, is there anything that I'm carrying with me from my past which is no longer serving me in my present? Is there anything I'm carrying with me from my past which is no longer serving me in the present? Just see if something comes into your awareness that seems to come from a deeper dimension of your being. Maybe it's 20 pounds. Maybe it's a habit. Maybe it's a belief. Maybe it's pain over a relationship that didn't turn out the way you wanted. Maybe it is a relationship. Maybe it's a job. Maybe it's all that clothing that is still hanging out in your closet that is just taking up space and blocking energy. So see if there's anything that your heart tells you that you're carrying that is not serving you. And now, if you have identified anything, ask yourself, would this be the time to start the process of letting go? Is this the time to let go of something that's not serving you? And again, you can't force this, but if you've identified something and your heart is saying to you, you know, I'm really tired of carrying this with me and it really is time to let go of it, then ask your heart to give you some insight into just one step you might take that would move you in the direction of greater freedom. So let's say it's something as simple as, I really think I should stop smoking a pack a day of cigarettes. That may not be easy to go from 20 to zero, but say, starting tomorrow or starting today, I'm going to cut down to half a pack. See if there's one step that moves you into a place of greater liberation, less encumbered by something that you're carrying with you from the past. Okay, now continuing with your eyes closed, please take a slow deep breath in. Hold it for just a moment. Now let it go. And now once again settle into your heart. And ask your heart, is there something that I'm longing for? Something that I'm craving? Something that I'm hungry for? Something that I believe would be useful or nurturing, desirable, that I've been holding myself back from, maybe thinking I don't deserve it, I don't have time, it's not that important, other people's needs are much more important than what I need. But see if you can identify something that might be nurturing or nourishing to you that you've been either consciously or unconsciously withholding. Maybe it's, I always wanted to take art lessons, but I never seem to have time. Or I really think if I started exercising regularly, I'd feel more vital, but I always seem too lazy at the end of the day. Or I really think I'm ready for another relationship, so maybe I should stop hiding out in my apartment all day long. So see if there's something that you sense, that your heart senses, would be nourishing, nurturing, life-supporting, happiness-generating, expanding, that perhaps you haven't been willing to allow into your life. And if you've identified anything at all, then again ask yourself the question, is this the time? Would this be a good time to begin that process? And if your heart says, sure, it's a good time, then once again, see if there's just one step that you could take that will move you in the direction of embracing and engaging and inviting something into your life that perhaps you've been holding yourself back from, something that you believe will bring you more happiness, more love, greater well-being, deeper connection to your own purpose in life. So now, once again, take a slow, deep breath in. Please continue with your eyes closed. Let it out. Now bring your awareness back to your heart. And for a few moments, bring into your awareness everything and anything for which you could feel grateful. Just start considering all those things, people, relationships, learnings, opportunities, experiences, for which you feel gratitude. And as you're entertaining those ideas in your mind, envision that your heart is beginning to glow with the sacred light of gratitude. So you pick a color of what gratitude would look like in your heart. And as you're considering all those people, things, relationships, experiences, opportunities, learnings for which you can feel gratitude, imagine that this gratitude is creating this glowing light in your heart. And as that light of gratitude glows more brightly in your heart, allow the heart to begin to distribute that with every beat of its heart, of the heart. So it's now the gratitude, envision the gratitude is being circulated into every organ and every tissue and every cell in your body. So you can now begin to imagine that your whole body is now glowing, radiating, filled with this sacred light of gratitude. And so now as you slowly come back into your body, let that sense of gratitude stay with you throughout the day. Whatever you're going through, whatever you're experiencing, let that underlying current of gratefulness be there at a subtle level. And then notice at the end of the day, right before you go to sleep, how did that inform your choices throughout the day? So wiggle your fingers and your toes a little bit, and when you're feeling ready, then slowly open your eyes. Okay, so let me give you a little bit of information. You know, my experience is that although there are things that happen that we could say we can blame nature for, earthquakes and tornadoes and non-understandable cancers, I think that you'd probably agree with me that most of our day-to-day distress is the consequence of human-to-human interaction. Do you agree with me that, like, on a day-to-day basis, it's not global warming that creates distress for it's how my spouse talked to me this morning before I left for work, or how I'm getting along with my kids, or whether or not my boss is a jerk or kind to me. Do you agree for the most part?
Yes.
I actually have a psychologist friend who during the Balkan Wars, decided she would volunteer at one of these refugee camps. And she was preparing for this with this expectation that the stories that she would be hearing would be outside of her expertise. You know, what do you say to someone who watched genocide right in front of them or were burned out of their house? But when she got there, she was quite surprised to find that most of the time the problems that people came to her with were the same problems that came to her in her practice in Manhattan. My boyfriend keeps flirting with that girl in the next tent. You know, my mother-in-law keeps telling me what to do. It's interesting how we can take this complex world and make it very personal and drive ourselves crazy as a result of these interpersonal challenges that we have. So I think that the skill set of learning how to better navigate these interactions that we have with the world is a skill set that is worthwhile for all of us to practice, to get better at. And it's our experience, it's my experience, that it translates not only into better relationship health, but better emotional health, and ultimately better physical health. So I wanted to show you these seven principles. I'm not sure we'll get through more than a few of them, but these are the idealized principles of what I like to call enlightened relationships. How would we behave with each other if we knew that we and the people with whom we're interacting are really the same field of consciousness taking on different forms? You know, in most of the Eastern spiritual traditions, there's this ultimate reality, which says that consciousness is primary, and then consciousness differentiates into all these different forms and phenomenon. That each of us is an expression of that underlying field of consciousness or underlying field of spirit, taking on a particular pattern of behavior for a certain period of time. But since most of us are not aware of that deeper connection to the unity, we get very caught up in our own sense of individuality. As we expand our sense of self and expand our own capacity for compassion, increasingly it becomes obvious to us that you and I are the same being in disguise. Or as the great Sufi poet Hafiz likes to say, that the ultimate reality that dawns when we are awakened and enlightened is that we're all God in drag. Okay? So what would it look like? What would it look like if we actually behave towards each other with that deep underlying recognition that you and I are the divine taking on a particular point of view for a fairly limited period of time? So the first principle is that you and I are equal. If we approach every relationship on the basis of equality, the whole world would change. Unfortunately, most relationships are based upon a sense of inequality. Either I'm above you or I'm below you. I'm better than you or I'm not as good as you. And that drives a particular dynamic which almost always ultimately leads to conflict. But there's a practice. There's a practice that we can engage in that begins to bring us closer to this realization that we are all equal beings. We call it the namaste technique. You know that word namaste? You know, people, namaste, it means the being in me recognizes the being in you and sees that it's one. Okay? So here's a simple technique. If you find yourself at times getting kind of arrogant and demanding and self-righteous, which are all expressions of the ego in a perspective of self-importance, or if you're kind of carry the idea that you're not as good as other people, that you're pathetic, that you don't deserve to have more, which is the ego's conversation of self-pity. Self-importance and self-pity are really the same conversation, just different sides of it. This is a way to get you closer to this place of my relationships are based upon equality. So for the next day, 24 hours, every time you walk by a mirror, look at yourself in your own eyes in the mirror and say to yourself as you're looking in the mirror, I'm beneath no one, I'm above no one, namaste. Beneath no one, above no one, namaste. Every time you walk by a mirror, okay, you'll be surprised at how many mirrors we surround ourselves with. Okay? After you've done that for a day or so and you're really comfortable, so you know it'll take like a split second once you've done it a few times. In fact, if you just say namaste to yourself, that's like the little sutra, the little code word from not above, not below, but the same. Then start doing it with other people. Just the brief moment. You don't want to stare at people because they'll take it the wrong way. But just for a brief moment, make eye contact and have that thought, namaste. Okay? And begin to notice what happens, not only to you, but to all the people that you make this brief connection with this underlying intention. Like next time you're at a busy restaurant, And, you know, the waitress or waiter is, you know, very frantic and they're understaffed and they're stressed and everyone's yelling at them. When the wait person comes to your table, just for a brief moment, look them in the eyes, have the thought, namaste. And notice how almost instantly that person's entire demeanor shifts. Because it may be the first time all day that someone saw them as a being rather than just as a role or a servant. And the very fact that someone has acknowledged them as, oh, here's a human being, that person feels nurtured, you'll get much better service at your table, and you'll see how powerful that underlying intention can have just by simply making eye contact. So that's the first principle. Again, we don't have a lot of time, so why don't I give you the experience of that, okay? Are you willing to do something kind of courageous? Okay, so turn to someone who's close to you, and declare that person as your partner. Okay, it can't be a menage a trois. So, if there's three people, quickly find. If you don't have a partner, raise your hand, and then quickly get up and find a partner. Okay, if you don't do it, you won't get any benefit out of it. So, quickly do that. Okay, anyone not have a partner? You didn't know I was going to make you work today, huh? Okay, now this is a fairly challenging thing to do for a stranger, but hold your partner's hands. I know we're already violating all the rules that you learned in kindergarten. Okay, hold your partner's hands. Okay, do it in silence so you don't have to make any ego chatter at this point. Okay, now this is something really, really challenging, which is I want you to now look your partner in the eyes. Okay, now notice at first how really uncomfortable this is, right? Because we're so used to disguising that essential self with our jobs, our clothing, our houses, our cars. You know, we're not used to people looking through all that stuff. Now, of course, as kids, we'd like to play staring games all the time because we didn't have so much to disguise. But as adults, it's very rare that we are comfortable just looking at someone at that deep level. But just for a few moments, get synced in that way. Just let yourself look into that person's eyes and relax your body so you're allowing the energy to flow. And just continue doing that while I tell you this poem, again from the great Sufi, 14th century Sufi mystic Hafiz says, "There's a wonderful game we should play, and it goes like this. Let's hold each other's hands and look into each other's eyes. And then I'll say, tell me a difference you see between us. And you'll say, David, your nose is 10 times bigger than mine. And I'll say, yes, my dear, at least 10 times. But let's go deeper. Let's go deeper still until our souls are so intertwined that even God cannot tell us apart. This is the wonderful game we should play with everyone." All right? So you've had like a little taste of this first principle. My relationships are based upon equality. Just try it. Make it an experiment. See if you notice anything shifting. If you're in a difficult relationship, there's somebody at work that drives you crazy. Instead of perpetuating the conflict, just for a moment, look them in the eyes, think to yourself, namaste. See if anything shifts for that. Okay? Let's go through one more principle. Does anybody have any questions? I can keep talking if you don't, but do you think that people will have questions? Okay, so I'll just
give you one more principle.
So this is an important principle. Yeah. The principle that those that I love and those that I hate are mirroring back aspects of myself. Those that I love are reflecting back aspects of myself that I want to see. And those that I don't like are sending back reflections of myself that I don't want to see. Now, of course, when we see something that we don't like about ourselves, it's so much easier to point to the mirror, right? To say, you've got to change, that person's. But then, you know, after a while, we start wondering, why do I keep attracting those same type of people into my life all the time? It's interesting how much we get a sense of who we are by the mirrors of our relationships. I was in Chicago with my family recently, and we were at the Museum of Science and Industry, and they have this whole room with these funny mirrors. You've probably been to one of these at like a county fair where you look into a mirror and suddenly you're really tall and skinny, or another mirror you're really wide and flat, or you know, your neck is really long or your legs are really long. And I was thinking about, as we're growing up, particularly those first 7 or 8 years where we have no filters, we're getting these reflections back. And if the reflection that we get back is there's something wrong with us, you know, you're fat, you're ugly, you're stupid, you don't deserve anything, you never amount to anything. As children, we never have the thought, maybe there's something wrong with the mirror. We accept that there's something wrong with us, right? And of course, that misunderstanding can last a lifetime. But we can start to correct that. We can start looking into clearer mirrors. So just to kind of get a taste of it, let's do one more exercise. Okay, so please close your eyes again. Now, this is out of my good friend Debbie Ford's book on shadow work. Consider a quality, a trait that you're carrying, that you have, that you think is very desirable. What is it that you really like the most about yourself? If someone said, "What's your best quality?" See if you could come up with a word or a short phrase that says, you know, this is really my best quality. Now, having identified this quality, consider how, as a result of this quality, you engage in the world. How do you express that quality in your relationships? So if you might say, my best quality is I'm so generous, then you may find that with all your friends, you're baking and cooking, giving them cookies, and you never pass a homeless person without giving them a dollar bill or whatever it means to be generous. But see how that quality that you have labeled as positive, as desirable, informs your behavior in the world. Continue with your eyes closed. And now, if you had to think about what was the opposite of that best quality, what would be opposite of that very positive quality? So if you said, my best quality is generosity, then maybe your opposite quality would be selfishness. Okay, so see if you can identify the opposite quality. And think about the associations that you usually have with that opposite quality. See how it makes you uncomfortable. Okay, now ask yourself, do you know anybody? Is there anybody in your life that has that opposite quality? Chances are pretty good that you have a number of people in your life who express that opposite quality. And those people with that are probably attracted to you because you have not been embracing that in your own awareness. And so ask yourself now, can you accept that that opposite quality is also a part of you? That although you like to see yourself as generous, yeah, there are times where you can be stingy. You see yourself as being outgoing and friendly, there are times where you just don't feel like talking to anybody. There's times where you are courageous. There are times where you're fearful and avoid things because you don't have the energy or the confidence that you can overcome that. So see if you can embrace the negative aspect of your positive quality. See if you can embrace the shadow side of that ego quality. Just accept it. And to the extent that you can accept it, you'll find that you reduce your invitation for other people who that quality is predominant into your life. So please open your eyes. Let me just give you a short example of that. Someone I saw fairly recently, actually. He was a sales consultant for a software company. And he came to the Chopra Center with a lot of stress. He was having heartburn and trouble sleeping and getting migraines. And when I asked him for a story, he said that, you know, the funny thing is that these symptoms started about 4 or 5 months ago when they hired someone new at my company. And the person that they hired was an IT person. And I said, well, what is it about this person that bothers you so much? And they said, he's just a pig. This guy is such a slob. He drives me nuts. So that's pretty strong language. What do you mean? He said, well, whenever he shows up at a meeting, he's always late. He's usually eating something while everybody else is paying attention. His shirt is always out. He doesn't seem to care much about his appearance. It just really bugs me. And it bugs him so much that he couldn't even concentrate on what was going on because he had that kind of inner irritated conversation about this other guy. Now, you have to picture the guy who was telling me this. Here we are at the Chopra Center, pretty laid-back, relaxed place. But, you know, he had a perfectly pressed polo shirt on, you know, perfect seamed in his J. Crew pants. You know, his loafers were polished. I mean, everything about him was impeccable. He could be right off the cover of, you know, GQ. I said, well, tell me a little bit about, you know, what were the messages you got about neatness? And it turns out he was raised in this Boston banker family. And by the time he was 5 or 6, the boys had to wear blue blazers to dinner table. And any time they were late, they would miss dinner. It was very strict, rigid, authoritarian, disciplined family. So for him, the message of being laid back, be easygoing, not be so obsessive about your appearance, those were quickly in his early childhood put into his shadow, meaning those were unacceptable. Now, when your shadow sees somebody else expressing those qualities, getting away with it, it drives your shadow crazy. It wiggles the cages. But if you can say, which is what we told him, why don't you try to embrace just a little bit of sloppiness while you're here at the Chopra Center? You don't have to be the first one to every class. You don't have to be so buttoned down. Just loosen up just a little bit. We give you permission. We'll still love you if you are a little bit looser. And, you know, it was kind of hard for him because the conditioning was so austere that to say it was okay and not expect to be punished takes some reprogramming, relearning. But he tried it. He was a few minutes late to classes. He unbuttoned a few buttons in his shirt. About 2 months later, he calls me and he says, my blood pressure has come back down. My migraines have gone away. And amazingly enough, I've actually gone out to lunch a few times with this guy. And I find that there's a lot of things about him that are really cool. And I'm just easier about it. So when you find that there's somebody bothering you, you know, Don Juan, Carlos Castaneda used to call these your petty tyrants, the people who just by their presence makes you irritated. Rather than running away or blaming that person, say, hey, what is that person saying about me? And if I embrace those qualities, maybe I wouldn't waste all this energy in self-importance or self-pity. And that energy that you're not wasting in defending a particular point of view, you have available to create, to be happier, to be healthier, to develop more nurturing relationships, to connect more deeply to your meaning and purpose in life. So this is just a little sampling of the Free to Love course. We're actually coming back in April to do a weekend course. We're going to be doing it at the Palace Hotel in New Montgomery. It's a 3-day intensive, Friday night, Saturday, half a day, Sunday. So if a result of this little time we spent together, you're sensing that maybe there is something that I'm carrying with me that might be best to let go of, and this simple exercise wasn't enough to take care of it, check us out, and we'd love to see you in a couple months. Thank you for your kind attention.
So, thank you for your introduction, and now we have time for 5 minutes of questions.
Yes, I just had a comment about Dr. Marianne Legato gave a lecture just 2 weeks after the 9/11 and made some comment about the effects of it will not be shown in the population of the world, actually. the United States mostly, but the people even that were right there in the New York area for many, many years. Can you comment on that? I didn't mean to bring us all down to a sad subject, but it seems important.
You know, when tragedies strike, most research has shown that the best way for us to get through that is to be open about our communication and our feelings. If we feel that we have to manage this on our own and be stoic about it, that's really where it festers and makes us sick and unhappy. So I think that collectively, you know, we're seeing it a lot. Actually, we've been invited recently to work with some of the returning vets from Iraq and Afghanistan, because, you know, the mentality of the warrior class is you never show feelings, you never express vulnerability, you never express weakness, and it's turning out that not only is there, you know, this phenomenally high rate of suicide, but lots of other illnesses are showing up much sooner in this younger population. So I think we have to cultivate we have to agree that it's okay to talk about our pain, and to, by talking about it and sharing it, and with the intention of releasing it, it doesn't mean that we're weak. If anything, it means that we're whole. And in that wholeness, then we can together solve the problems of the world and not carry it with us and pass it on to generation after generation, which has certainly been our tendency. Think about all the festering places on Earth that you can trace back who hit who 5,000 years into the past. You know, it's time for us to let go of the past and start creating a compelling future that's worthy of our children.
Boy, I'm really tempted to follow up on that question about 9/11 and about the foolishness of trusting our governments and trusting Middle Eastern governments, but I'd sort of like to draw back to a question which is probably more deep concern to most of the people in this room, which is that looking at the prices in your catalog, one thing Ayurveda seems to have in common with conventional medicine is a focus on money, and lack of money is one of the major stresses most people in this country have. How would you handle that?
You know, abundance is an interesting thing. In traditional Vedic thought, the question is raised, you know, do you worship the god of money or do you worship the god of wisdom? The god of money in Ayurveda is known as Lakshmi, and the god of wisdom is known as Saraswati. If you worship Lakshmi, if you go for money, if money is something that you're preoccupied with, you may get money, you may lose money. It's probably not going to create very much in the way of satisfaction. If you go for wisdom, it's said that if you worship wisdom, if you worship Saraswati, Lakshmi gets jealous of you and starts chasing after you, trying to seduce you by throwing money at you. Okay? So my encouragement is, if money has been an issue in your life, to ask yourself, what do I really love to do? Like, what makes me happy doing it? What is kind of resonates with my natural intrinsic talent in life? This is a principle in Vedic thought known as dharma, that everybody has a purpose in life. And if we were really expressing that purpose in our lives, we'd have enough money. Now, how much is enough? It's very personally dependent. You know, we take care of some of the wealthiest people on Earth at the Chopra Center. And I can tell you, having $4 billion doesn't make people happy. In fact, if you're a billionaire heiress, it's very difficult to trust that anyone loves you, because it's hard to see through billions of dollars. So what I would say is, the book is, what is it, $20. Most people can afford that. And I would say if you went through the book, you'd probably get 90% of what you'd get if you spent 2 weeks at the Chopra Center and spending several thousand dollars. So don't let the money question get in the way of making healing, transformational, and awakening choices in your life. There's actually a sweet story from the Kabbalistic tradition that I like. It says that this wealthy man bought a vacation home on a lake, and he would hardly be able to ever get there, but when he was there, he would see that on most days there was this poor fisherman, and he'd watch the fisherman fish for about an hour. He'd catch a couple fish, and then he'd go. After watching him for a while, the rich man approached the fisherman and said, you know, I'd like to give you some advice. Would you like to hear it? The fisherman said, I'm open to anything. So I'm a very wealthy man. You can see my big house there on the lake. And I've been watching you. And if I were you, instead of just fishing for an hour a day, I'd fish for 2 hours a day. And with the extra fish, I would go to the market and sell them. And I would save up my money. And after about 6 months, you'd have enough to buy a boat. Then you could go out to the deeper places in the lake, catch bigger fish, sell them in the market, save more money. Pretty soon you could have a fleet of boats. Then you could hire a bunch of people to work for you. Then you'd have so much money that you could spend your days doing anything you wanted. And the fisherman looks at the guy and says, thank you so much for your advice, sir. But to tell you the truth, I am spending my days doing everything I want. So who's more abundant? The essence of abundance is doing what makes you happy. Materialism is not going to make you happy. Doing what you feel passionate about with people that you love is what's really the essence of abundance. So I would vote for that, and then Lakshmi will come trying to throw money after you.
Our thanks to Dr. David Simon for his comments here today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to this recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 107th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.